Thelema, Coast to Coast, Show 18, January 8th, 2006. Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to the first Thelema Coast to Coast of 2006. My name is John Crow, and I'm the host of the show. I apologize about not getting this show out sooner. It seems the holiday season with work and family and schedules made it difficult to talk to some of the guests that I have on the show. However, on today's show, I have a variety of programming, including a talk with Melissa Mayhem from Massachusetts about the magical use of tattoos, a discussion with Keith418 about strategic goals and the OTO's lack of strategic goals, and lastly, a conversation with Jerry Cornelius about his book, Aleister Crowley and the Ouija Board. Before getting into the programming, though, I do want to announce the winner of the Grass Games contest. On the Thelema Coast to Coast website, I stated that anybody who signs up for the site up to and ending November 30th was entered in a drawing to receive 4 free games, the deluxe game set, from Grass Games. The winner of the contest was randomly chosen by Grass Games by number so that no identities were used, and the winner is Sarah from Imperial, Missouri. So congratulations to Sarah, and keep an eye out for other Thelema Coast to Coast promotions. We still have the Thelema Coast to Coast sticker promotion that if you send in a postcard to the podcast, that postcard will entitle you to receive a sticker in return, as well as the postcard being scanned and put on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. Right now, the website has just under 20 cards, and in the last month since last podcast, I've added about half a dozen cards, so please go to the website and check those out. Those are my brief announcements, and so now we move into the first segment of the podcast, which is the interview with Melissa Mayhem about the ritual use of tattoo.
We have on the phone Melissa Mayhem from Knights Templar Oasis in Massachusetts. Are you there, Melissa?
I am.
Welcome to the podcast, 93.
You, 93, John. Good to talk to you.
One of the things that I've been looking at lately is the use of tattoo in ritual, and that's why we're kind of talking, or the magical use of tattoos. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, before we get into that, though, how long have you been a tattoo artist?
It'll be 15 years this February.
And you create most of your own tattoos, as in you draw them with pen and ink or other materials?
Yep, pretty much. I mean, everything is custom designed. That's what I prefer to do, and that's what I do at the studio.
Where is your studio?
Lightwave Tattoo in Saugus, Massachusetts.
Now, when you're saying you draw the tattoos, do you work with the client, or do they just kind of give you a general idea, and then you go and draw it and show it to them, and usually
I'd
they approve it?
I have to say that, 80% of my clients, will come to me, and they'll want to, they just give me an idea. They just come in, and you kind of have to be part psychic in order to do this kind of work, because people come in and they're afraid, number one. Number two, they're really excited. And number three, they have no idea about what they can or can't put on their bodies. So I have to work with them, and they give me a little bit to go off of, because, I mean, if you don't feed me, I can't create something for you. And then pretty much I take it from there, and I go into my own references. It sounds corny and flaky, but I do a lot of dream work on it and a lot of meditation on designs. mm-hmm. and then just whip out whatever it is. And most of the time they like it. And then you have 20% that come in and they want to stand over you the whole time while you're drawing. And they're control freaks. But for the most part, most of my clients are really, really open-minded and they feed me. So I appreciate that.
Getting into the magical use of tattoos, can you give some ideas of how tattoos are used for magical or ceremonial or ritual purposes?
Sure. Well, what a lot of people don't realize is that tattoos actually started as a magical ritual. I mean, we have mummies that have been unearthed in Siberia and in Uzbekistan that have been found to have been marked from the hands to the shoulders to the legs to the lower lumbar region, rather, of the back. And these were done for medicinal purposes as well as for ritual purposes. Even in ancient Egypt, mummies of dancers and priestesses of Hathor have been found with markings around the abdomen and the vaginal area that were believed to be sort of fertility markings as well as markings to enhance their beauty and their eroticism, if you will. So pretty much the magic and the ritual of tattoo has been around for thousands of years. And it's now in modern times with this sort of throwback to like these primitive rites that modern people are trying to reconnect with their ancient past and use body modification rituals in order to kind of bring more magic into their lives. So when I do magical tattooing or I do ritual tattooing for people, it's usually to mark for initiations or life changes, or even in some cases I have done some medicinal tattoos for people to try and, affect the meridians, the energy meridians in the body, which also ties a lot into acupuncture, which I wish I could get more into, but my life right now is so busy with tattooing as it is, I don't think I could branch off into Eastern medicine, but there's a lot of parallels between the use of acupressure and acupuncture as well as using tattoo.
Now, what other kind of examples do you see on a day-to-day basis of people getting tattoos for magical use? Now, you mentioned initiation or life changes. Or can you give some more detailed examples of how people have been using tattoos?
Sure. I mean, like the majority of my clientele, I mean, I have a sparse magical clientele, and I have people that come in that are looking for magic that don't realize it until they're actually sitting down at my seat. But for the most part, the mundane people that I work on that have no idea about the tattoo as being a magical ritual or a ceremony in itself, many of these people are looking to sort of reclaim their bodies. One of the best artists in the field, Guy Aitchison of Hyperspace Studios, coined it perfectly, and that's we're basically post-genetic re-engineers, and we're doing something that only your parents could have done when you were in the womb, and that is creating you. So as a tattoo artist, you're sort of taking a vision and placing it on these people's bodies. So when people come in, they're looking for closure. Many times you do memoriam tattoos for somebody that they may have lost that was very close to them. And the whole ritual of the tattoo sort of brings out sort of a physical pain, but it also draws out that emotional pain, and it gives them some sense of closure. We have a lot of people that come in to get tattoos to mark their marriages, which is not something I particularly condone, but if the person or the couple feels strongly enough about it, I'll definitely serve their wishes. A lot of people come in to get tattoos to mark a point in their life, like the proverbial midlife crisis. I get a lot of people that come in that are just like, you know, I'm born again. I've changed my life. I'm seeing things differently. I want to get a tattoo. It's something that was taboo, but now that I'm old enough, I can break away from my family and my parents and sort of state my independence by marking my body. And that's a lot of what I do mainly. It's a lot of people that are coming of age, a lot of 18-year-olds that walk in and they want to mark the fact that they're adults now. And that's, I think it's a wonderful ritual. I mean, it's always been sort of the realm of the priestess to initiate people into a new stage of life. And I just feel that ties totally into what I do on a magical basis as well as a mundane basis.
Now, you mentioned clients as in you have a number of repeat clients, is that correct?
Oh, yes. Yep, I have many of those. I mean, I have regular clients now that I've been working on since 1996.
Now, is that they have multiple tattoos or do they have large tattoos that take multiple sessions? Or
a little bit of both. I mean, I have some people, like the American idea of getting a tattoo is sort of to get like random tattoos all over the body, kind of like amassing a huge sticker collection on your body. And then I have other people that are more Eastern thinking, and they're looking at the body as like a huge canvas. Like one of my clients, this guy Boris, we have a huge cosmic tattoo that stretches from one shoulder to the other shoulder and then down onto the tops of his arms. And it's pretty much Michelangelo's God creating Adam, where the two hands are touching each other, but in the center is this huge galactic spiral like the Milky Way, and then all the planets are lined up with Earth in the center. And he just got like the eye of God recently, and 2 or 3 years ago we did the sun on his left shoulder. So this is like a thematic piece, but it has to do with his sort of combining religion with physics and outer space and all these concepts of art and creation. So he's someone that's been with me since 93, and we've continued now into 2006. So, yeah, big pieces, little pieces, you name it. These are people that, you know, I've sort of become their initiator, if you will.
What about other religions? Do you find a lot of people celebrating their Christianity or Islam or other spiritualities with tattoos, not just magical or occult?
I will tell you that I don't have many Muslims that come into the studio, but I have worked on a lot of people from the Hindu traditions that have gotten, like, the Tridents of Shiva, a whole group of brothers that all worked together, had decided on one of their birthdays to get the Trident of Shiva, so I got a whole slew of them in, and it was really interesting because they were so happy that their tattoo artist knew what it was that they were getting and why they were getting it. There was sort of, you know, a whole coming-of-age thing, and they had all kind of moved away from India and had started a successful business in Boston. And they wanted to mark this occasion by getting the Trident of Shiva. So they were thrilled. They couldn't believe that I had a tattoo of Kali on my back. They just loved it. So, you know, they kind of stuck with me. I have a lot of Christian clients, and it's really funny because the majority of them are sort of hardcore fundamentalist born-again. But the thing is that they're so committed to their faith that they want to mark their bodies with, like, pictures of, you know, the crosses of Calvary. Or I just did one now called, I think it's a painting called Redemption, and it shows Christ upholding this individual who's holding a mallet and a nail in his hand, and he's sort of collapsed into Christ's arms. And as born again as he is, and I've talked about Thelema with him, and he's talked to me about Christianity, he's never once tried to convert me, but we both have found this sort of, like, common ground where just as people we work well together, and as long as we follow our own ways and, you know, let it be, we just have a wonderful working relationship. So, and I appreciate that because I think it's nice that I'm able to offer a service to people no matter what their faith without either one of us having to proselytize to the other. People, you know, they walk into my space and they see, you know, I have the Otil Laman on my wall. I have, like, the Sigil of Baphomet on my wall. I have all kinds of magical symbols all over the place. I have books up on my bookshelf. And people look at them and they're curious, but, you know, it's not an offensive thing. They don't take any offense to it, and they're pretty open-minded. They'll even look at them. They'll look at the books and crack them open and read them, and, you know, they nod their heads, they smile, they put it back. But it's a nice sort of, I like to live by example. I don't think that by yelling and screaming and proselytizing we're going to get anywhere, but I think that if we do our art and live our lives and walk our paths, people eventually, you know, there's a mutual respect there.
Now, you mentioned other kind of body modification, piercing, implants, scarring. How does that fit in?
It fits in a lot because it goes back again to that whole modern primitive vibe where people are trying to reconnect with ancient rituals in order to sort of, I don't know, come to terms with the modern world. I mean, in the modern age, we're in an age of 24/7 communications and artificial sunlight. So people are trying to harken back to other ways that they can sort of shift their consciousness and their psychology. One of the most popular ways these days is through something called suspension, where people are pierced in various areas of the body, namely the nipple area, like in the movie A Man Called Horace with Richard Harris, where he performs the Lakota Sioux sun dance, where he dangles from a pole and receives a vision because his body goes into shock. A lot of people, they do these things, like these huge conventions where they get together and have suspension conventions, and they pierce their bodies and dangle and receive visions. I think it's just our modern nature to try and hearken back to these ancient ways to kind of find some sort of connectedness to the spirit and, again, to the earth type of a thing. So it's very tribal, very primitive, but at the same time, it all ties in with tattooing, where the people of sort of the south of the equator continents would pierce and scarify themselves, like the Mayans and the Aztecs, and then you have the different tribes of Africa that did scarification and massive body modification with, like, plates in the lips, or the Mindele women who put the rings on their necks and elongated their necks. You have more of the people in the northern hemisphere who would tattoo their bodies, but it all kind of goes back to that whole healing, medicine, strength, and also a marking to show your status in society. And a lot of tattoos were used for that in ancient times, to show priestesses, priests, chieftains, and warriors.
How are tattoos used for identity?
For identity? Well, in Japan, they were used primarily to mark criminals. And in certain cultures, also in the East, many times people were marked specifically for crimes that they had committed, whether it was a mark on the forehead, somehow markings on the hands, or tattooing the whole back. In America, sort of the tattoo was associated in the turn of the century with the sailor, the whore, pretty much the ne'er-do-wells of society. But as time has gone on, we look back now in research and find out that people like Winston Churchill's mother was tattooed, and people in Britain in the early 1900s, were tattooing because it was considered exotic, and it was a luxury item to own a tattoo because it was from the Far East, and it was so different and so strange and yada yada. These days, you know, tattooing, it just goes beyond all strata of society. You have the lowest of the low that scrimp and save for months and months and even years to get a tattoo, to the wealthiest surgeon down the block who comes in and hides his tattoos under a suit. I mean, I tattoo administrators for the MBTA, which is the Massachusetts Bay Authority Transportation Group, and you'd never know that this man had, like, 75% of his body tattooed. You know, he comes in a three-piece suit, and he takes it off and gets tattooed just like the guy who comes in from the bar down the street and plops down $100 to get, you know, his kid's name on his arm.
Well, the things that I've been reading about have been talking about some of the advances in inks and application techniques. Can you expand on that?
Well, pretty much. We've been using the same technology now since 1891 when Samuel O'Reilly developed the first tattoo machine. And we can also thank Mr. Edison for creating the tattoo machine for us, because it was originally based on his model of an embroidery machine. And Samuel O'Reilly took it and created what we use these days as the tattoo machine, not a gun, because it's not a gun. Needles pretty much have come a long way now that we have laser-precise machines that can cut these things. We have even more variety in our tools that we use. And a lot of people get freaked out because we say needles, we use needles. It's not the same as a hypodermic where you go into a doctor and, you know, you penetrate many layers of skin to hit a vein. And if you ever hear anybody talking about hitting a vein, and they're not going to a tattoo artist. Should never go that deep. But as far as pigments go, most pigments are organic. There are some companies that do manufacture acrylic-based pigments, and they're not harmful. I've talked to many plastic surgeons, and they've told us that acrylic-based paints are not a problem, but they have to be specifically made for the skin. But there have been many advances. I mean, back in the 1800s and 1900s, you had green, a mercury-based red, a black, and kind of a cadmium yellow that was used. And those were your choice of colors. Now we have everything from fluorescent pink to chartreuse. You hear about people talking about, ultra-light reactive pigments. We don't recommend things like that. Like, a lot of hardcore tattoo artists will not tattoo someone with quote-unquote UV ink or glow-in-the-dark ink, because they've been proven to turn brown in the skin after 3 or 4 years, and they also can cause cancer. So we try to steer people away from those things, and we try to stick with more traditional techniques.
What about the effects over time? Do the newer pigments spread out and blur like the old pigments? I mean, everybody's seen pictures of old sailors where their tattoos are just these big blobs on their arms.
Well, that's another thing, too. I mean, you're talking about sailors. They're out in the sun all the time, or they're exposed to the elements manning a ship. So no matter what, if your skin is exposed to ultraviolet over a long period of time, ultraviolet is going to blast away the pigments, because laser is pretty much ultraviolet light concentrated to the umpteenth degree in order to blast away a pigment, and you can have laser removal to remove old or bad tattoos. But as far as modern pigments these days, they do withstand the test of time a heck of a lot better than the old pigments that people back in the 70s and the 80s, early 80s used to use. But they will, over time, no matter what, disperse. In fact, Dr. Chris Sperry, who works for the Alliance of Professional Tattoo Artists, has said on many occasions that if human beings lived to be 200 years old, by the time we were about 100, the tattoos would completely disperse on our skins and we'd be bare.
Really?
Yep.
So he's estimating that it takes about 100 years to disperse completely?
Yep. I mean, I have tattoos that I had done 15 years ago when I first started to really get tattooed and when I first started to tattoo. And you can even see single lines that were at one time very crisp and very clear have now kind of blurred out a little bit. And that was done with a single needle, which is a very difficult needle to work with because it's so fine. And you can either have a line disappear within a couple of years, or you can have a line completely blow out and look like a larger cluster, I guess, or a larger configuration of needles had left a line in your arm. And these things have just fuzzed out over time. And it also, the other thing a lot of people should consider, too, before getting a tattoo, is that if you get it in a very fleshy, pliable area and you plan on either gaining weight or building muscle, like in the case of a lot of bodybuilders that come in and get these really super fine bands, over time, because of weight loss or weight gain, whatever, the tattoos will change in the skin because of the body. They either move, like sometimes you'll have a design placed in the center of the arm, the guy works out for 5-6 years, bulks up, tattoos either in the back or the front of the arm. And also with longevity, we try to consider that when we place tattoos on people's bodies. So if you're an 18-year-old girl that gets a tattoo on her hip, 20 years from now, that tattoo could be in your stomach. So you have to take these things into consideration when you're getting a tattoo.
If somebody wanted to get a tattoo, how would they contact you?
The best way to contact me is through either email, which is melissa@melissamayhem.com, or by calling the studio directly, which is Lightwave Tattoo in Saugus, and our number is 781-233-1780.
And do you have a website?
I do. It's melissamayhem.com. And right now, actually, we're kind of revamping the site. There's a lot of old stuff on there right now. But if you went to the Boston Tattoo Convention website, which is bostontattooconvention.com, and then clicked on Artists and Vendors, and then went to Melissa Mayhem's BTC page, there's more of an updated portfolio as well as a bio and information there that people could get.
Well, other than your studio, is there anywhere else that people can get a tattoo from you?
Yes, actually, if people are interested, January 12th through the 15th, I'm going to be working at the Marked for Life All-Female Tattoo Artist Convention in Kissimmee, Florida. I believe it's at the Radisson Gate Hotel, and it's like $15 to get in for the day, and you get to see tattoo artists from all over the country. I think we have a few international ones coming in from Scotland, and I'd be happy to do tattoos there. It's best to just come on in and come over to the table. I'll be there with Jessica Melusine, selling her fanzines and poppets and stuff, so be a lot of fun.
Well, wonderful. I really appreciate you taking the time and talking about tattoos and then the magical use of tattoos. It's something that has been very interesting to me over the years, and
well,
I was happy to find you and find your ability to talk about this.
Oh, yeah, I can babble forever about it. You want to hear any more? But it's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for the opportunity. It's like there's so much more, too, that I could expand upon, but I've probably babbled enough.
Well, maybe we'll have you on again in the future.
Why, sure.
All right. Well, thanks, 93.
Thanks, 93.
Strategic goals are very important for organizations to accomplish anything meaningful. Unfortunately, the OTO has yet to come out with its strategic goals. So Keith 418 and I talk about that and the results and possibly why the OTO is resistant to having strategic goals.
We have on the phone Keith 418. Are you there, Keith?
Hey, yes, I am. 93, John.
93. About 6 months ago, we had Craig Berry, the Internet Secretary and an SGIG of U.S. Grand Lodge, on the show. And during that show, he said that they were working on strategic goals, and he was part of a strategic planning committee for U.S. Grand Lodge. He estimated that the strategic goals would be out by the end of 2005, and here we are 6 months later, and U.S. Grand Lodge has not released any strategic goals, and I remember talking to Sabazius about this over a year ago. Why is it, do you think, that there are no strategic goals yet?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I haven't been privy to the committee meetings. I don't really get their emails. They haven't consulted me about it, so I can't really say for sure. And they could produce the goals any time now. I mean, they could produce them tomorrow. So we don't really know. I mean, I can speculate in saying that the OTO has been really resistant to any sort of strategic planning at all. The basic ideas of nonprofit groups, of setting goals, of having accountability, of looking at a strategic plan that's got, you know, measurable metrics, there's accountability, it's on a timeline, the goals are realistic. This is not something that people cotton to or seem, you know, that enthusiastic about on a basic level. And I mean, I think it's unfortunate that a lot of the push for this is actually happening from people that are not really in charge of the order, but are sort of down the pecking order quite a ways. And they're the ones that are saying, hey, we've got to start doing this on the local level. We've got to set up more plans, have more accountability, take this more seriously, do more long-term planning. And that they're not really getting that as a model, unfortunately, from the national or international bodies. And I think that's unfortunate because unless it's modeled and really demonstrated and even taught to the local bodies by the national organization, the national organization sort of begins to look kind of crazy. I mean, it doesn't seem to make too much sense. But they've been very resistant to it. I mean, you say, well, why don't they have it yet? You know, I pushed for this starting, I think, in 1999. I said, you guys need to do some strategic planning. And, you know, no one really bit on it then, and it's been a kind of uphill fight. And I kind of get the idea often that, you know, people are pushing them to do it, but they don't really want to do it.
One of the things that I find interesting is U.S. Grand Lodge has been putting on the CABA Colloquium leadership training for a number of years now, and they fly various representatives for U.S. Grand Lodge all over the United States to local bodies to do 1, 2, or 3-day presentations about various planning, organizing timelines, and they consistently give the line that bodies need to set goals, they need to set short-term, medium-term, long-term goals. They need to do timelines. They need to have meetings to see how that's progressing, what we often call metrics. They also talk about modeling the right kind of behavior for the body so that the body master and the body officers have to do various behaviors so that the other members of the body see the proper way to behave. And as you just said, then they turn around and they don't do the same thing themselves. They don't model short-term, medium-term, long-term planning. They don't model communication. They don't model follow-through. Even when they make loose type of commitments, Craig Berry saying, oh yeah, you know, we'll have those out by the end of 2005. That was 6 months ago. They've done nothing about that.
I think there's a very strange sort of push towards congregationalism that you get with this, where the local bodies are told, I mean, I had this discussion with Grand Lodge officers where I said, look, you know, you're saying that changes are coming down the pike and you're going to do planning and whatnot. What's going to be demanded of me as an individual in the OTO? Am I going to be asked to do more? Am I going to ask to give more money? What demands are going to be made on me? And they said, well, we can't tell you that. It's all going to be on the individual local level. So, you know, I can kind of say, well, then if my local body doesn't decide to do anything, you know, hypothetically, or doesn't have any serious goals or doesn't really have its act together, does that mean my life will go on the same as it always has? I mean, how can you just devolve everything down to the local level and still think that your national leadership and your national prestige isn't going to be diminished? And this is kind of what I don't understand. If every local body is supposed to come up with its own plan and do its own work and hold itself accountable and set all of its stuff itself, what is the national organization really there for at all? You know, a lot of times people say when we talk about these goals that you and I are trying to force the local bodies into some uniform straitjacket where every local body has to meet certain uniform goals that may not be appropriate for their area or their particular circumstances. And at the same time, you know, there are certain criteria for what an oasis has to do, what a lodge has to do, what a camp should be doing, that are for everybody no matter where they are. So those sorts of standardized uniform goals are already in place, and I don't see people complaining about them. But then when we turn around and say, well, no, you know, actually we'd like to see goals for each local body that are submitted and checked and supervised and people are held accountable to them by the national organization, then no one says anything. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, if the local bodies really have to set goals, and what happens if they don't achieve them, and what happens if they blow them off or fail to do them? Well, what are the consequences? How does the accountability work? All of those questions go unanswered. They're sort of uncomfortable. You know, like, well, we want to look like we have goals, but do we really have them or not? How meaningful are they? This I don't get a lot of answers on. So I guess what I'd like people to think about is, you know, would you go to work for a business that didn't have a business plan? I've worked for nonprofit groups that had very strong commitments to strategic planning. That's one of the reasons why I think the OTO needs to do it. And I wouldn't go to work for a nonprofit that didn't have a strong strategic plan. I mean, who would go to work for a business or a nonprofit that was run this way? And that's kind of what I don't understand. Why is it so difficult for people who work real serious jobs where there is planning and accountability and goal setting as part of their daily lives? Why do they have such a hard time translating those skills and those expectations into the OTO. And that covers a lot more than just strategic planning, but it's certainly very evident in that circumstance.
Well, the other thing is modeling discipline. If U.S. Grand Lodge wants its local bodies to have goals and meet those goals, then it too has to have goals. It has to meet those goals. It has to publish timelines, and it has to hold itself accountable.
And if it meets
its goals, then it should celebrate, and everybody should celebrate the meeting of the goals. And if it doesn't, then it should look at why it didn't meet the goal
and hold
and
itself
then
accountable.
Yeah.
Yeah. And hold itself accountable and say, look, we set this goal, we didn't make it, here's why, and this is why we're going to do better the next time. How can they expect their subordinates, even on the local level, to do that if they don't do it? And that's what I don't understand. I mean, on the one hand, they say, well, we want people to be honest and upfront and open with us. Are they being honest and upfront and open with the members?
Well, if they
say they want you to deliver on the goals that you create, but they don't deliver on the goals they create, what kind of example does that set?
Many times, inexperienced leaders think it's a sign of weakness when they admit that they didn't meet their goals, that they made a mistake, that they made a bad judgment. However, those who have been in leadership for a long time realize that when you make an error, it actually strengthens your position to admit your error. If you say, oh, my bad, mea culpa, and then go and try to rectify the situation that your error caused, you're going to have a lot more credibility from people than if you turn around and try to sweep your errors under the carpet. Look at how the Bush administration right now is getting hammered for all the secrets that it's trying to do.
I totally agree.
I see somebody getting in trouble for saying, okay, I made this error, unless it's, you know, blatantly illegal. But if people say, look, I made this error, it was a bad judgment, I'm trying to rectify that now, here's what I'm going to do to rectify that, most people are going to look at that person and go, oh, okay, well, let's give them another chance.
Right. I think one of the problems is that weak organizations and weak leaders feel the need to deny that they ever make mistakes or fail to come through on commitment. And if the organization is so weak that it can't be honest with itself about these kinds of problems, what does that really suggest? How did it get to be that weak, and why is everyone afraid to tell the truth and be honest and admit that maybe they don't want to do the strategic goals? I mean, maybe they've decided that the strategic goals are something that, you know, people like you and I push, but that they're not really needed by the OTO and they're not important. And I would argue against that, but if they've made that decision, why not come out and say that?
That's the question that I always ask. If they truly are committed to strategic goals or some kind of model such as the Blue Equinox model, and they say that that's the case, why don't we see movement towards those goals? And if it's not the case, okay, well then why don't they come out and say, we're actually not interested in moving towards the Blue Equinox model anymore? And people are going to look at that, and some may disagree with that and some may not, but then they're going to have to turn around and say, but this is the model that we are going to work for. And then that's when people can judge whether or not they want to be participating in that kind of model.
Well, at least it would give everybody, we get everyone on the same page and create some unity. And the question is, do they really want that unity and the consequences of what comes with it? Or do they want to appear to be all things to all people and be the widest possible tent they can be? And I think, you know, you and I have looked at this before in terms of sect and church and in Kone's work and other studies of this, that doesn't really work too well in the long run. And you can't be all things to all people. And, you know, unfortunately, on the one hand, they're telling very, very serious people, perhaps people even more serious than us, look, we can't do that. And they're telling the people who are really, really unserious, perhaps the people who are, you know, far more unserious than we can even contemplate, look, we can't tolerate your behavior either or your expectations for how loose it's going to be. And somewhere, you know, have a large middle range. But I don't think that that's going to hold for too much longer anyway. And I think it's unfortunate that they've bailed on the strategic goals, because I think that that would be something that would help the group. I think it's kind of common sense, and it's depressing to me to sort of have to argue the common sense of strategic goals with people, especially people that use goals in their business lives. I mean, why are we in the position where we have to even have that discussion? That's very depressing. But what's more depressing is, I think, the idea that they think that they're going to get more by not having them.
Well, this is a topic that can go on for quite a while, but unfortunately we only have a few minutes on today's show. So let's pick up on the next show and continue to see where things are.
Okay.
All right, 93.
93, John.
In 1917, Aleister Crowley wrote a small entry in the newspaper, The International, in which he talked about the magical use of Ouija boards. Recently, Jerry Cornelius, the author behind many of the Red Flame series, has released a book on Feral Press called Aleister Crowley and the Ouija Board. He also has recently released a 2-volume biography about Hymenaeus Alpha, or Grady Lewis Mercury, the former Grand Master of the OTO in the United States. We talk with Jerry about his books, and in particular, his Aleister Crowley and the Ouija Board book.
We have on the phone Jerry Cornelius. Are you there, Jerry?
Yes, I am.
93, welcome to the podcast.
Ah, thank you.
Now, you have been very busy lately and have come out with a number of books, including one on Feral House, Aleister Crowley and the Ouija Board, as well as a 2-volume set with Red Flame series, number 12 and 13, a biography of Grady Lewis McMurtry, former Grand Master of the OTO, Hymenaeus Alpha.
That's correct.
Well, let's start with the Aleister Crowley and the Ouija Board book.
Okay.
What was your inspiration for writing this book?
Well, actually, it goes back many years. It goes back with Grady. He used to come out to my house in Connecticut all the time. And one time when we were out there talking, you know, about the spiritualism and just normal crud like that, the subject of the Ouija board came up. And I was actually really shocked by how seriously he took the board. And so I had to ask him questions about it. And that's when he unfolded a lot of Crowley's views. So over the years, I've just been sort of taking a lot of these views and writing them down and putting them into a book format.
Now, Crowley also wrote about the Ouija board in a brief article in the International, correct?
That's correct, in 1917. I think Akkad republished it in Crystal Gazing.
And then also, Crowley, according to your book, Crowley and Akkad also talked about using the Ouija board as a tool for communicating with spirits.
That's correct. Some of the correspondence still survives between Crowley and Akkad. And I quote some of the letters in the book, trying to explain how Akkad tried to use it to evoke Enochian angels and stuff.
All right, well, let's take a step back and say, what makes the use of the Ouija board different from how people just use it in a, I guess, more as a game or party tool than using it as a ceremonial magic tool? What does your book talk about that makes it different?
Well, before we get into that, I think one brief thing should be pointed out of Crowley's views, and that is if you look at a lot of the Golden Dawn techniques and how they would actually use forms of scrying, why they actually go inside of a crystal or inside of some sort of magic mirror, and the angels appear, especially like with John Dee, and they would appear before huge tablets, and the angels would just point at letters inside the spheres, and one by one they would spell out this whole series of words. Well, Crowley believed that if you could, and even so at the Golden Dawn, that if you can go into the astral realms, you can come out into this realm. And by doing that, what he would do is he would put a huge magical triangle on the ground, like in Vision and the Voice, and actually summon the entities out into this plane. Well, Crowley believed that the Ouija board was the same exact methods. That little heart-shaped triangle or plochette was actually the means whereby the spirits could actually move the boards and point the letter by letter by letter. The thing that they talked about, though, was control. That was the key to the proper use.
Now, what do you mean control? Control of the board, the planchette, or the environment, or...
Well, you know, if there is... If you hear a knock at the door, and you open the door, and it's some stranger, you don't invite them into your house. The idiocy of the Ouija boards is that most people who use them just let any Tom, Dick, and Harry entity that happens to be in the area communicate through the boards. Crowley talked of control by creating this huge magical circle around the boards and actually creating a temple situation where you would actually know exactly what entity you would summon, and you would continually evoke it over and over again in ritual situations to strengthen a bridge. So the control was you knew who you were calling and working in that level.
Now, when you're saying drawing a circle, are you saying just doing like the normal vanishing ritual and casting the circle with some kind of
sure.
watchtowers or
That's
anything
correct.
More elaborate? What about You were mentioning Enochian before.
Mm-hmm.
Do you use the Enochian calls or Enochian implements?
I've done it for years with Enochian calls. You have to remember with John Dee, when John Dee and Edward Kelly were doing some of their scrying, they never had temples. They didn't set up and create this mass rituals around their holy tables and spheres. They literally just sat and prayed. And in their prayers to God, that's when the entity would come. So there was nothing really that elaborate. And so basically Crowley believed the more elaborate you go sometimes is not good when working with elementals or Enochian entities. So a simple circle to make sure you keep out all negative forces is just about good enough.
I know at the end of your book you give a brief ritual that people could follow, and you have a few of the Enochian keys in there.
Right.
How do you decide which Enochian keys to use?
Well, I'm going with the basics that it should be earth. You should always work with earth first.
Okay.
If you understand a lot of elemental workings, you're better off working with the closest elemental force nearest you. If there's any things that are going to go astray, and it's very complicated, but you're better off not working with fire or water or certain elementals that you're not really good control with yet. So earth is always the best.
And once you have established a connection with earth, would you then recommend moving on to air and then water?
No, I would stay with earth.
Okay.
I would stay with earth completely. And it's complicated, but there's reasons for that. There's not the necessity to go to all four. Not in the early stages. The thing we want to do with a ritual is evoke often with the Enochian boards, with the Enochian workings with an Ouija. Because a lot of people will sit down and do one or two things or type of settings with Ouija boards and get no results.
Mm-hmm.
But if we study the history of the Ouija board and look at all the different case upon case studies that bordered on everything from possessions to hauntings and poltergeists, it was a repetitive use over a long period of time that made these almost troublesome events occur. And the thing with these type of events, where a lot of people will sit back, especially a lot of the Christians, and a lot of the books on Ouija are written by a lot of Christians who are fearful of the board, they consider it like a passkey to evil. Where Crowley, and I agree, and with Crowley and Grady and a lot of them, where all these type of events of possessions and invoking poltergeists where they terrorize a home and so forth prove beyond a shred of a doubt that the board is capable of bridging the world. The problem is, again, control. We can't just allow any Tom, Dick, and Harry to in our house or in through the board or whatever. You know, there is a type of control we have to learn.
The first part of your book, you spend a number of chapters going over the history of
Correct.
The board. Why did you think it was necessary to include that?
Well, I felt there's a huge stigma on the Ouija, and there's no doubt that it's there. Once spiritualism took over the board, and it's much older than the spiritualistic movement, the actual boards themselves, because they go back to ancient China, to Greece. Many groups have used types of boards. But somehow the stigma of that spiritualistic movement we've yet to be able to shake. And when you look at Crowley trashes spiritualism. He hated his spiritualism with a passion. And when you read, like, Magic Without Tears, he just goes in-depth trashing it. And of all the things that he hated, he never trashed the Ouija board in relationship to spiritualism. So there must be a reason why.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff. But I wanted to more or less bring people up the queue of some of the history of the board. So this way I just don't want them to accept it. I want them to show where the history came from.
Is your book marketed towards people who are already established magicians or established ceremonial practitioners, or is somebody who has very little or no experience with that, could they get your book and actually go through it and start using it to use the Ouija board as a tool?
Well, that's a good question. That's a dangerous question. It's one of those arguments that we've had here at my house when we've talked about the board. Because in a way, it's geared to the serious magician trying to explain to them how they could use the Ouija.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we knew that to even publish a book like this means that any Tom, Dick, and Harry could sit back and try to do the experiments. But, you know, there comes a time when you have to sit back and say, if an idiot is an idiot, they're going to be an idiot. And I can't be responsible for every Tom, Dick, and Harry who picks up the board and tries to do the rituals and is stupid.
Well, is that why you included your epistle on the pentagram ritual to hope people get a good use of the banishing?
That's correct. That's correct. Because it really is important. Really is excellent. And it's the blowouts that you have, and I've seen so many different weird occurrences that have happened through Ouija boards, that people freak out, and the actual banishing ritual gives them a sense of control, brings that back. And so it's important to learn the banishing.
So it should ideally be used by people who are familiar with evocation and ceremonial magic, but
In theory, the Ouija board has been played by people, though, for over 100 years through the type of a game that we have. So, and they've been having phenomenal success from it.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that you'll always have people that are stupid with the board, and you'll always have people that are actually really, really good and can use it and so forth. The average person on the street can obtain through it. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. But the magician can read between the lines, if you catch my drift, and can actually see the book and take it to its next stage.
Now, you have mentioned a number of times in the book and just recently on the podcast, elementals. What about contacting other Enochian entities or goetic entities, such as demons or angels or governors, things of that nature? Is the Ouija board good for that?
Well, in theory, it's a passkey. That's all it is. I mean, so who you in contact is up to you. Personally, I don't believe in demons, and I think people misunderstand what the Goetia is all about, especially OTO members. They forget the fact that the goetic forces of the lesser key of Solomon are balanced by the greater key of Solomon and the angels. So the angels and the demons have to be balanced. So people that pick up the goetic forces, they deserve anything they get. If you look at a lot of the Abba Malen workings, the Abba Malen balances the angels and the demons very, very careful. And a lot of people forget that with magic. They want to go either or, and you can't go either or. So the elemental forces, I would sit back and say, are the number one thing you should try to work with first.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the example that Grady always had, I have a great recording of Grady talking about trying to contact the President of the United States. And they always sat back and said, if you tried to call the man, you'd never get through. But if you contacted, let's say, your representative in your area, and you follow the chain of command upward, you may be able to get through to make certain types of requests. And the same thing with Enochian. A lot of people want to contact the great kings or a lot of the great angels or the hierarchy, and then they bemoan the fact when they don't necessarily get any great results. And in truth, you should work with the lower and most easiest elementals the elementals first. And so little by little by building a bridge.
You quote from Crowley's essay and from the Akkad letters. Why did you not reprint Crowley's essay in the book?
I didn't find it necessary.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not one of those type of people that just keep rehashing every single thing. I think some of the stuff that irritates me, well, a lot of the modern Crowleyites are just padding their books with other people's works. That's just annoying.
Mm-hmm. When did you write this book? Is this a recent production of yours?
Actually, it was written, almost 6 years ago. So it's been a while for it coming out. But I've just sort of been preoccupied.
Okay. Well, this is great. Unfortunately, I don't think we have much more time to get into Grady's biography, but would you be willing to come back in the future and be
sure.
on the podcast again to talk about the biographies of Grady?
Sure, no problem. I would love to.
If somebody wanted to get your book, Aleister Crowley and the Ouija Board, where could they obtain it?
Well, everybody from Wisers is carrying it, if you want to contact Wisers, or you can contact Farrell House directly, or you can just give me an email at Cornelius. 93.aol.com, I'll give you the information.
And do you have a website also?
Sure, Red Flame website.
I'll put a link to it on the show notes.
Something like redflame93.com.
All right. Sounds great. Thanks again for being on the podcast.
Oh, sure, anytime.
93.
93 now. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So this brings us to the end of another Thelema Coast to Coast. I want to thank all of the presenters who are on the show, including Jerry, Melissa, and Keith. Our outgoing song is by a group called Mercury, and the song is called Morning Star. In general, it is an instrumental song. About halfway through, the artist has made a novel use of Crowley and his Enochian recitations. So overall, I thought the song was pretty good, and the Crowley Enochian goes very well with the song. So without further ado, I give to you Morning Star by Mercury. Love is the law, love under will.
I'm going to go to the hospital.